What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Many of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, which is my effort to find the most interesting people in the world and sit with them for hours while I ask questions in an effort to learn. So it would mean the world to me if you would subscribe to the show on your favorite audio platform, watch episodes on YouTube, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. My goal is to help millions learn from the world's most interesting people. So let's get into today's episode.
Today's episode is with Darius Dale, the founder and CEO of Fortitude Macro. We get into global liquidity and why that is driving so much of asset price movements. And then we talk about inflation and politics. We're headed into an election season. And so how will that play into financial markets? Darius has all of this and more for us in today's episode. I hope that you enjoy it. Here is my conversation with Darius Dale.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Today's episode is brought to you by Proppy. Imagine a world where you could buy and sell your home wallet to wallet. With Prop Keys, you can mint your home address and upgrade it to a real-world asset. This not only protects your home's title from fraud, but when you are ready to move, you can sell it through an NFT auction as well as through the traditional way. There's optionality here. Proppy Keys is part of the Proppy ecosystem. Their mission is to make home ownership more efficient, affordable, and user-friendly. Proppy Keys is a fun entry point to placing title on the blockchain. Now, anyone can start their on-chain journey by minting home addresses via Proppy Keys and staking them for profit until they are ready to sell their home. Visit ProppyKeys.com to learn more. Again, that's ProppyKeys.com to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Bet Online. Do you like making a profit from sports betting? Well, set yourself up to take home the most profit possible using crypto to fund your sports betting, casino, and poker account at betonline.ag. You can avoid costly transaction fees, get your payouts lightning fast, and do it all securely and anonymously with the highest deposit and withdrawal limits in the industry. If you want to get in on the action, do it the smart way with crypto at betonline.ag. Head to the website, sign up with promo code POMP100 to get 100% bonus on your crypto deposit today. If you go and you deposit, they'll give you 100% bonus if you use promo code POMP100. Bet Online. The game starts here. BetOnline.ag. Go check them out today.
All right, guys. Bang, bang. I've got Darius here. Darius, inflation data comes in. Everyone thinks inflation is falling and the world is going to be perfectly fine. Is that true? It seems like maybe that's not true.
Hey, what's up, man? It's good to be back. So it's true and it's not true. So this the title of our morning note this morning was mixed signals on the inflation front. And I do want to emphasize mixed. So we put together a series of charts for you guys today to kind of go through some of the data points that we got over the last 24 hours with respect to inflation in the U.S. So the first chart, we just show a headline CPI, food CPI, and energy CPI. And in each of those panels, the blue bars represents the three-month annualized rates of change. And the red line represents the year-over-year rate of change. And as you can see, headline CPI accelerated to 3.9%. Three-month annualized, that number is basically double its pre-COVID trend. It was driven by an acceleration in energy CPI, the third panel down there, to 4.5%. So we are now growing in terms of energy price inflation, which is a phenomenon that we've largely escaped for the past kind of year and a half.
And when we see this inflation data, obviously there's multiple ways to measure it. There is year over year, there's month over month, there's, you know, kind of regular CPI, there's core, there's all these different things. How do you see each one of those individual signals? And do you try to take the totality of what's each one telling you? Or do you zero in, like at the Fed, I think their like core PCE number is like the one that they really like and kind of point to always. But what do you think about the different ways to measure and kind of the manipulation of the data?
Yeah, the great question. Phenomenal question. That's one of the questions we are all tasked with as investors, and certainly something that we have to do here for our institutional clients at 42 Macro, which is to parse through the data to figure out what's actually signal versus what's noise. And with respect to trying to understand dynamics in inflation, you know, to your point, there are a lot of different indicators that we can use. But generally speaking, you know, we want to understand what the preponderance of evidence is signaling. That's kind of step one. And then step two is what are policymakers focused on? And then step three is what are the leading indicators for the indicators that the policymakers are focused on. If you can answer each of those three questions whenever you receive any data point or any collection of data points from economic reporting agencies, you're going to do a better job than the average investor who's really not combing through all the data on a regular basis. So in chart number two, you know, kind of addressing this, you know, kind of a preponderance of data scenario, we have all the various measures of core inflation. So the first panel shows just regular core inflation that accelerated to 4.1%. 3-month annualized, that number's well above trend. We saw the part of that acceleration was really driven in part by some of the stickiness of services. We saw that was flat at 6%, 3-month annualized, well above trend, more than double the trend rate. And then we saw core service or super core, which is core services X housing, which is one of the preferred metrics that Jay Powell's been highlighting in recent months. That number accelerated to 6.7%. On a 3-month annualized basis, that number is more than double the pre-COVID trend. So we're seeing some real stickiness in some of the more services, core services elements of inflation, and that's causing broader inflation measures to remain sticky.
Now, when we look at this underlying inflation, what's fascinating to me is some of these are trending in the same direction, but underlying inflation, there's obviously a measurement of it, but there's also this element of like, psychological inflation. And what I mean by that is just like the Fed has got interest rates at 5.5%, stock market's at an all-time high, Bitcoin's at an all-time high, and people are spending like maniacs and they don't give a shit what the Fed is doing, right? Oh. Like there is this underlying component that I think you're getting at in this third chart. But then there's also just like, if people ignore the data and continue to act in an inflationary way, then the data actually will follow the like actions in psychology more than the people follow the data, if that makes sense.
100%. It's reflexive. It's always has been and always forever will be reflexive. I mean, so what we're seeing now in terms of this backup in inflation that we've observed over the last couple of months, in our opinion, this is just the lagged impact of the monetary easing that we experienced as investors and as people over the past few months. Recall that asset markets, if you look at US dollar money markets, whether they be Fed funds futures or overnight index swaps, priced in a significant degree of monetary easing over the next 12 months and really over the next 2 years, over the past few months, as a function primarily of the Fed's dovish pivot. And as a function of that, we are now reaping both the benefits on the growth side, but also the harm on the inflation side of that monetary easing. So a great example of this is on chart three, where we show underlying inflation. Median CPI, which takes the median change of all the, let's call it, I want to say about 420 different subcomponents of inflation. That number decelerated modestly to 5% through month annualized, which is more than twice its pre-COVID trend. And then we saw trim mean CPI, which just takes the same measure, but it lops off the bottom eight and top eight percentiles from the data to get a more trim mean measure. And that number is at 4.3%, accelerating to 4.3%, which is double its pre-COVID trend. So if you look at not just the main categories of inflation, but also just the general breadth of inflation is actually pretty sticky over the past few months. And in our opinion, that's partially a function of the monetary easing we saw priced into markets.
Now, you've got this small business like optimism survey. And again, it goes back to kind of psychology. If people are optimistic, they act one way. If they're pessimistic, they act a different way. What's this telling us?
Yeah. So just taking a step back, one of the things that I think we do really well that's really different from the average research provider is that we analyze every single major economic release in the world on a daily basis in rate of change terms. And we contextualize that for our clients. Most of the time, the data is noise, so we don't even report on it. But there are times like this where we actually have to say, hey, look, this is actually creating signal for us in terms of altering our forward-looking views on the economy and or policy. And so with respect to the NFIB survey data this morning, we got that at 6 a.m. Most people didn't even pay attention to that. But when you break down all the different inflation subcomponents of that, whether it be the higher prices sub-index, the price plans over the next 3 months index, the compensation index, and the compensation plans index, all of these measures slowed sequentially and are at multi-year lows. And so even though we're observing a, I don't know, stickiness of reported inflation in the CPI statistics over the past couple of months, we saw it in the PC deflator statistics a couple of weeks ago, we do believe that stickiness is likely to prove transitory and ultimately resume its downtrend over the medium term, because we continue to see survey-based leading indicators continue to point to a downward trajectory of inflation.
When we look at energy prices, you've got a couple of charts here. It feels like real estate, Bitcoin, and energy are all things that people are getting more bullish on because they're basically getting more bearish on like the legacy system. What are you seeing in the energy markets?
Yeah, 100%. So this is one of those things that is kind of going on stealth in the background. If you throw up slide five, where we show the indexed performance year to date for front month gas, gasoline futures, front month WTI and Brent crude oil futures, and then front month nat gas futures, we see that gasoline futures, which obviously will eventually impact consumer wallets from the perspective of gasoline prices, those are up 23% year to date. And so this is obviously the real key takeaway is it's actually on the next chart where we show, or the next two charts rather, where we show that energy as a share of total personal consumption expenditures is only about 2.4%. So that's only in the eighth percentile of monthly readings going back to January of 1959. So the rise in energy is not likely to cause significant problems for the from the perspective of consumer spending. But the next chart is the real key takeaway here on slide seven, where the rise in gas prices is likely to negatively impact consumer confidence because energy, food and energy are those two main variables that tend to drive consumer confidence readings, particularly the University of Michigan numbers that we're going to get on Friday at 10 o'clock. And so the key takeaway is there is that Biden, which is now demonstrably trailing Trump by 4 percentage points in betting odds, whether you look at the predicted numbers, that, in our opinion, is likely to increase pressure on the Oval Office and on the Treasury Secretary Yellen to continue buying votes with accommodative policy, whether they be with spending, accelerating, authorized spending into the economy from some of the acts like the CHIPS Act or the Inflation Reduction Act, or it could be on slide eight with Yellen continuing to implement net financing policy that drains, that effectively drains the reverse repo facility balance. It's currently at just shy of $500 billion. And oh, by the way, that $750 billion target for the Treasury general account balance at the end of Q2 could easily be revised lower, to something that looks like $500 billion, which effectively means there's about $500 to $750 billion of sort of untapped and likely soon to be released liquidity, U.S. liquidity into asset markets over the next 1 to 2 quarters, if they really start to panic at those odds and how Biden's chances of reelection are trending.
When we look at the liquidity globally, obviously the United States has been trying to contract. Politicians, again, they missed the memo. They've been just spending like idiots. If we look in ECB and BOJ, they've been contracting. PBOC, they've been expanding. What do you expect for global liquidity over the next 12 months or so? Is it something that it doesn't really matter what the US wants to do because they're going to get overpowered internationally, or should we actually try to understand a little bit better about each one of these central banks and some of the nuanced decisions that they're making?
Yo, great question, man. So in our opinion, we think the latter. You want to understand all the moving parts of the calculation so that you can understand when things are going to start to accelerate or decelerate in a way that could change the broader global liquidity picture. One thing that's been very positive for global liquidity, I think we talked about this a few weeks ago on the program, is the real aggressive liquidity provision that we continue to see out of the out of China vis-a-vis the People's Bank of China. They have very aggressive economic targets for 2024, 5% GDP, plus 12 million in terms of urban job creation, 3% CPI up from, it was deflation a month and a half ago. So in our opinion, those very aggressive policies, which are effectively calling for an 8% nominal GDP growth in a country where last year they grew 5%. In our opinion, we think the PBOC is going to be forced to keep its foot on the gas pedal and continue to promote easing financial conditions in the mainland economy, which continues to promote the rising, the uptrend in global liquidity. So this is something we've been all over. We've been calling for that for the past few months since right around mid-December and anticipating that the Chinese authorities would front-load policy support early in calendar 2024. And that front-loaded policy support has come to fruition, but it's our expectation that it's going to remain in place over the medium term in light of these incremental figures. So that's when one of the key drivers of the positive uptrend in global liquidity that we've been calling out vis-a-vis our research since right around mid-November. And then we also have some of the key countercyclical drivers of global liquidity supporting liquidity creation in the private sector. This is something you and I've been talking about for years now, which is the central banks aren't the only, entities in the world, the agents that create liquidity. Commercial banks create liquidity, non-bank financial market participants create liquidity, corporations create liquidity when they generate profits, workers create liquidity when they earn money and keep some of it in savings. So all these things create, you know, zero duration assets that get funded, you know, that, that gets transferred around and changed into, you know, liabilities throughout the global banking sector. So in our opinion, you know, those kind of those key countercyclical drivers of liquidity, like the U.S. dollar, like bond market volatility, like currency market volatility, all those things, you know, have been in trends that support the liquidity creation in the private sector. And in our opinion, those things are likely to remain in place over at least the next quarter or two. But what's going to cause all that to end, in our opinion, is when the narrative around immaculate disinflation really starts to erode and gets replaced by what we think will be sticky inflation at some point in the second half of the year. Once market participants really start to sniff that out, all those key countercyclical drivers of global liquidity from the perspective of the private sector will stop going and stop trending in the direction they have been trending, and perhaps start to trend in the opposite direction, which will cause a private sector liquidity start to contract. But that, in our opinion, is a quarter or two away.
And interest rates play a piece of this. Can the politicians trump the Federal Reserve, though? Like, if we get more fiscal stimulus, we're in an election year, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that could still happen between now and then. There's opportunity. We obviously have proxy wars. We have the southern border. We have immigrant crisis. Like, there's a bunch of things where the government could step in and provide lots of funding. And so how do you measure maybe like the weight you put on what the Federal Reserve is doing with liquidity and what the politicians are going to decide to do with some of the fiscal stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's important. The reality is the policy rate has very little to do with the liquidity creation here in the US. And if you think about the amount of private non-financial sector credit that is on the bank balance sheet here in the US is only 33% of the total. So the other 67% is being created by non-bank financial market participants, which means that which are more reactive to changes in, you know, broader market conditions than they are to changes in the policy rate. The banks themselves are a lot more tethered to the changes in the policy rate, but again, it's only about a third of private non-financial sector credit here in the US, which is one of the lowest shares in the major world. So we definitely believe that, you know, as market participants, you know, really, you know, assess and reassess their expectations for Fed policy, that has more of an influence on liquidity creation and the trend in liquidity vis-a-vis its impact on broader financial market conditions, like credit spreads, volatility, the valuations of the equity market. You know, those types of things matter more to private sector liquidity creation here in the US than the actual policy rate itself, even though the policy rate is important.
And if we get into the latter half of this year, the Fed does start to cut rates, seems to be like people still believe that, but maybe that's like waning on a daily basis. Is there a world where we get no rate cuts or actually rate hikes? And so we're talking about liquidity and easing and, you know, all these things, but like, could we actually have a tighter financial situation going into the election?
Yeah, I mean, it'll feel like rate hikes when it comes along. They may not actually implement rate hikes, but again, the monetary policy isn't driven by the policy rate. It's driven by expectations around the policy rate. That's why the monetary policy really started to impact asset markets and really started to impact the economy very early in the cycle, in the rate hike cycle in 2022. You know, don't forget the Fed didn't finish getting to the terminal policy rate until July 2023, but we were already done with the market crash and the economic slowdown and all the associated negative impacts because the money markets, the US dollar money markets and global money markets front ran the actual changes in the policy rate. So what is likely to happen is we experience rate hikes from the perspective of what's priced into Fed fund futures and from the perspective of what's priced into overnight index swaps. These are key money markets, that the key money market instruments that investors use. And so that will feel like rate hikes. And if we do happen to go into that scenario, which again is our modal outcome expectation with respect to, you know, 2 to 3 quarters away, that will be represent a tightening of financial conditions that is likely to cause what is currently a Goldilocks market regime to morph into something that's more risk off, which would be inflation.
And then if you had to look at kind of end of year, stock market is up pretty big, Bitcoin's up pretty big. Are all asset prices up, you know, through the end of this year? Or do you think that there's some risk that, you know, NVIDIA is so much of the stock market return that if that thing comes down, then actually the stock market could be flat to down? Or how do you think about, you know, maybe such a hot start to the year and how we could end the rest of the year?
Yeah, it's going to be very hard to have a down year one, just given the starting point of, you know, being up pretty significantly year to date for most major risk asset classes. But that's not to say that we can't have a significant correction entry year. I mean, it's our expectation that, again, once it becomes clear to the most astute market participants who are doing the kind of, you know, granular research that we are doing here at 42 Macro, once it becomes astute to them that immaculate disinflation is over, and more importantly, if we're correct on our forecast, that immaculate disinflation is probably going to end at a level that is unplowable from the perspective of the Federal Reserve. If those two things become true, we will transition from a risk-on Goldilocks market regime to a risk-off inflation market regime. And that transition is probably going to create some significant volatility and deep corrections in asset markets. Now, does that mean that the markets are going to be down year to date on December 31st? Probably not. But it does mean that there's a lot of, you know, positioning that could change, change hands and ultimately, you know, to get investors more right sized in terms of the forward looking risk from that point forward. Because, again, in our opinion, a no landing scenario is the highest probability outcome with respect to the economy. And until that changes, you know, we got to believe that at some point immaculate disinflation is going to run out. And once it runs out, if it stops at an unpalatable level, we're going to have some problems in asset markets. Now, again, that doesn't mean you need to have a crash. Well, markets crash for three reasons. You have a sharp and or unexpected slowdown in growth. You have a sharp or unexpected acceleration in inflation, and or you have a sharp or unexpected tightening of monetary or fiscal policy, and or both. And so without any of those things happening, you know, it's very unlikely that we have an actual crash. But again, you can have a deep correction in like the stock market. You very easily see a 12 to 15% correction in the stock market in the context of what we're talking about. Could easily see a 30, 40, 50% correction in Bitcoin, which would take you back to, you know, levels that are very high still, you know. So in our opinion, you know, trying to, you know, play pin the tail on the donkey on December 31st, you know, that's a kid's birthday party parlor game. You know, in our opinion, we're trying to manage real, you know, institutional financial risk.
Where can we send people to find you on the internet?
Appreciate that. So, obviously come check us out at 42 Macro if you want to stay on the right side of market risk. And if you do not want to stay on the right side of market risk, God bless you. We'll catch you back here in a couple of weeks.
I appreciate it. We'll do it again in the future.
Absolutely, brother. Cheers, man. Thank you.